Will the clerk call the next case, please?
The court will now call Edwards Wade Taylor Jr. versus the state of Texas. May the court proceed with ball for arguing for the appellant. Mr. Matthew Wade for arguing for the defendant.
Afternoon. May it please the court, counsel for the government. My name, of course, is Wes Ball. I'm going to argue on behalf of Mr. Taylor. We filed a brief alleging 3 points of error, and I'm going to direct most of my comments to the first 2 points of error. The third point of error, the case law in Texas has traditionally been against that point of error. However, the United States Supreme Court may look at the unanimity issue set out in that point differently. If it ever gets to that court. Mr. Taylor, as you know, was convicted in his jury trial of the offense of continuous sexual abuse of a child following his plea of not guilty. And the trial and a review of the record will show that this is a classic he said, she said sort of a case. The trial was a battle of credibility. And so that's the context in which we have to look at these issues. During the trial, the state did essentially everything in their power to prevent anything that would detract from the credibility of its complaining witness, and as we set out in point of error number two, purposely presented inadmissible evidence to bolster that witness's credibility. The first point of error deals with what can be termed as false outcry, and basically how this went. And the state had filed a motion in limine requiring the evidence to be presented outside the presence of the jury before the court ruled, and that was certainly not a bone of contention. And so what had happened is the complaining party in this case had made an outcry to her mother that the appellant had committed certain acts of sexual abuse against her in the home where he lived, and she described the appellant as her favorite uncle. Later, a team, I think Detective Gildon of the Arlington Police Department, who was the primary detective on the case, described this as a multidisciplinary team, which consisted of the police, medical personnel, child protective services, forensic interviewers. A forensic interviewer by the name of Ms. Shercliffe conducted a forensic interview of the complaining witness to gather the details of the complaint about the favorite uncle. And it was during that interview the complainant said not only had her favorite uncle, Mr. Taylor, the appellant, committed sexual abuse against her, but she said his son, who she describes as her favorite cousin, had done something similar, had engaged in sexual abuse activities regarding her breasts. And so with that setting the stage, the defense argues and argued at trial this outcry, which we established to be false, would be admissible.
Well, counsel, you say that the outcry was established to be false. As I read the cases, isn't it usually the case that an outcry is false if there is something other than the allegedly falsely accused person saying, no, I didn't? In other words, the complainant confesses to somebody else, hey, I made it up.
I think, and if you look at the cases, and I stand to be corrected, but all of the failures to establish that the outcry was false were things such as CPS ruled it unfounded, a grand jury no-billed the case, or some other deficiency, not something that was direct evidence. Certainly, one way it might be established to be false is that person, in this case, his nickname was Three, he was appellant's son in the United States Marine Corps, and he testified at trial. But he got up and testified that the accusation that was made by the complainant against him was false. He was never charged by the government with any crime. I think the state, during one of the colloquies with the trial court, said that case was under suspension. It had not been determined whether charges would be filed. However, one way of being establishing it was false, and the state argued this at our trial, was a jury has not found this man not guilty. Well, the government made the choice not to charge him, and so they control that issue. But in this case, what establishes the falsity is the testimony of Three, the son, that accusation is absolutely not true.
And would your analysis change if he was currently under indictment for it?
No, I don't think it would change. I believe he's not presently under indictment.
But if he were, would your analysis change?
No, because I think the issue would then be for the jury to decide whether it's false or not. You have the gatekeeper that says, does it come in at all? And certainly if the, like a no bill from a grand jury, that wouldn't be adequate because a grand jury, and I've been doing this a long time, can no bill a case for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with whether the crime actually occurred. So that doesn't tell us that the crime didn't occur, that it, or the allegation was false.
So any evidence of falsity, including just a denial that it occurred, is sufficient?
A denial by the person that was there, a factual...
The accused.
Then in this case, three, would be sufficient. Absolutely. That's
any
our position. In any case. An opinion by someone that it's not true, not good enough. A no bill, not good enough. A CPS ruling, no reason to believe, not adequate or good enough. But a verdict of not guilty, a denial of the person that's being accused, that's subject to cross-examination by the government at trial, yes, I think that does, our position is, that does establish the falsity, and I could find no case that said it had to be in one category or another. And this was the issue and the basis upon which Judge Young, the visiting judge, Everett Young, ruled this evidence to be inadmissible because we had produced for the court the victim saying that three had abused her, and she reported that in this forensic interview in which she was talking about appellant initially and primarily. Ms. Shercliffe, the trained professional a forensic interviewer testified this outcry was made during the interview about appellant, and then three testified, of course, that he didn't commit this act. And so you've got all of these things that should have allowed this to go to the jury, and the jury could decide to reject three's denial and say, well, like father, like son, or accept it and then address the credibility of the complaining witness, the victim, on her allegations against appellant, which obviously was one of the purposes this was presented. The state's position at trial was, well, this was irrelevant or it was not proved false, and I've kind of addressed that. The premier case that underlies all of this is Davis versus Alaska of the United States Supreme Court, a 1974 case, the main opinion by Justice Berger, and it talks about confrontation, which is our complaint. It's a constitutional complaint, and the tool and the power of cross-examination, which allows the jury to draw inferences regarding the witness's credibility. And so it presents an inference. The rules of evidence in Texas have some restrictions, but those always must yield to constitutional provisions, and you can see that in Rule 412.2. E and 101C of the Texas Rules of Evidence. I did note that the government's brief focuses on, well, this is just an attack on the general credibility of the complainant, and therefore it's not admissible in that vein. Well, you had you didn't have two remotely separate events. And there's some cases where there's a offer of evidence that on some previous occasion the complainant falsely accused somebody of something. This is going on in the same multidisciplinary interview regarding this case. It consisted of complaints against the favorite uncle, who's the appellant, the favorite cousin, who's three, the son. It was the same type of offense. Complainant, when being questioned about the veracity of her claims, seems to get relief when she makes a claim of sexual abuse, which is one of the theories of arguing that she was not truthful. I did see a case, and it's not in the brief of either party, but I was kind of interested in this idea of the scope of what circumstances can come in. And there's a case called Carroll versus State. It's out of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and I'll read the citation in the record, 916 Southwest 2nd, 494, and this is at pages 497 through 98. It's a 1996 Court of Criminal Appeals case, and it says that this is admissible to show bias and motive It says the field of external circumstances from which probable bias or interest may be inferred is infinite. The rule encompasses all facts and circumstances which, tested by human experience, tend to show that a witness may shade his testimony for the purpose of helping to establish one side of the cause only. In this context of this case, this heated credibility battle, the second thing that the state did was they asked a question to Detective Gildon that produced the answer, and the Child Protective Services, one of the multidisciplinary agencies in this team of police, medical, etc., ruled the victim's complaint reason to believe. In other words, this official government agency had vetted this claim and gave a seal of approval.
Well, and I think the state concedes that shouldn't have come in, but don't we have to presume that the jury followed the admonition to ignore that bit of testimony?
Well, I would like to think that jurors do that, but if you look at the context of this case, and in most of the time I would agree with the court, that would be the situation. However, it was the last question asked of Detective Gildon after I cross-examined Detective Gildon at trial, and it was the only question asked. And they knew well that this was not admissible. It was a desperation attempt to bolster the credibility of this complainant, who we at trial attempted to put some information for the jury to discredit, that is the false outcry, and we're stopped in that endeavor. And then this last bit of piece of inadmissible information is put out. We submit that question and its desired answer was purposefully asked. There is no other explanation. It was done on purpose, and the instruction was inadequate in the battle of credibility that we had in this case to expect a jury to disregard it, because that's what they had to struggle with. Who do we believe?
Well, other than the allegedly false outcry, was there other evidence that the defense put on to attack the complainant's credibility?
There was. I mean, we had to use what was otherwise available to us. The complainant had made the initial at-home outcry to her mother, and the description of the circumstances and what was going on in the child versus parental relationship was vastly different. The mother testified that the child had been in trouble for not going to bed in the evening and not getting up for school and being late for school. She was being required to stay in bed with the mother, not in her own bedroom, for that purpose. This is when, and so our argument was, this was a basis for which to direct attention from the trouble we're in for not going to bed at night. Our favorite uncle has molested us, because that usually causes parents to forget about the staying up all night and focus on the real circumstances.
But the defendant had other things to attack her credibility on other than the false outcry that was not allowed to be put in front of the jury?
There were other things, but obviously the result of the trial showed that they were woefully inadequate, and so the importance of every piece. The state was permitted to, for example, establish the appellant during a police interview with me present, made a comment, a voluntary statement to the detective regarding some information regarding a coworker and a birthday message sent to the victim in the case by phone or text, I don't recall which. And so the detective went out and talked to the coworker at her place of employment, and that statement by appellant was simply not true, and they were permitted to, you know, attack his credibility with that separate specific incident. But again, it was tied into one of the investigative interviews, and it detracted from his credibility, and there's no question that had damaging effect on the appellant, who testified and had to concede that he lied to the detective about that aspect. So we're asking this court reverse and remand this case to the trial court so that a jury can determine whether in fact her outcry was false, just listening to the evidence and the cross-examination of three by the state of Texas on that issue, and supposedly if three has been indicted or convicted, I guess that may put an end to that, but if it hasn't, then they should make that decision and make a fair assessment of the credibility of the complainant and the validity of this charge. With no other questions at this moment, I'll stand aside for the government's argument. Thank you.
May it please the court. With respect to appellant's first point of error, the state's position is the trial court did not err by excluding the proffered testimony because it was inadmissible under Texas Rule of Evidence 608B, and its admission was not required under the Confrontation Clause. It's also the state's position that the Court of Criminal Appeals decision, 2009 decision in Hammer versus State, is what provides the proper framework to analyze this issue. And according to that case, to determine whether a jury should hear evidence of a prior purportedly false outcry of a victim in a sexual assault case, the question isn't, is there any evidence that the allegation is false, or is there direct evidence that the allegation is false? The question is this: is the evidence offered to attack the general credibility of the complaining witness is the evidence offered to impeach the general credibility of the witness for truthfulness, or is the evidence a more focused, particularized attack that reveals some kind of motive or bias?
So I assume that, and I haven't read that Carroll versus State case that that the appellant brought to our attention. But the passage that was read to us, you would take issue with the proposition that the Court of Criminal Appeals was sort of opening up and expanding the idea of what bias or motive could be in a situation like this?
Yes, the state would contend with that, yes. And so if the evidence is just a mere attack on the victim's general credibility, the Confrontation Clause doesn't require its admission, and the trial court can properly exclude the evidence as a violation of Rule 608B, which prohibits the use of specific instances of conduct to attack a witness's credibility. However, if the evidence does reveal a victim's bias or motive to testify against the defendant, then the rules of evidence and the Confrontation Clause may very well require its admission. And in this case, the record clearly demonstrates that the evidence offered by appellant to show this purportedly false accusation against three, the victim's cousin, it was a mere attack on her general credibility. And when appellant offered the testimony initially, his argument to the trial court was essentially, you know, this is a he said, she said case, so the jury should be able to hear about this so it can determine who it's going to believe. And the state's position with regard to that is nothing more than a general attack on credibility. And there was nothing in the proffered testimony that revealed any sort of bias or motive that the victim had against the defendant or her cousin. In fact, as mentioned by opposing counsel, the record actually revealed the opposite, that, you know, she enjoyed a good relationship with both before the defendant began sexually abusing her. So, because the proffered testimony was offered solely to attack the general credibility of the complaining witness in this case and did not reveal any evidence of motive or bias that she had to testify against the appellant, the trial court did not err by excluding it. And again, it's the state's position that the Hammer case is the case that outlines the proper framework to analyze this issue, and that because it's a more recent Court of Criminal Appeals case, it's more relevant to this analysis than the cases cited by appellant in his brief, the Thomas case, and other intermediate Court of Appeals cases from the 80s and early 90s. But even if we were to analyze this issue by that framework, the state's position is that the result wouldn't change. It's because those cases stand for the proposition that a victim's prior accusation of sexual misconduct against the third party is admissible when it is shown the accusation is false. And I believe a fair reading of those cases altogether, they suggest that a showing of falsity is accomplished when the victim actually admits at some point, either to a third party before trial or on the witness stand, that they actually made a false accusation. And that's what happened in the Thomas case. That's actually what happened in the Hammer case as well. But that didn't happen in this case. When appellant cross-examined the victim, CT, outside the presence of the jury, she maintained the truth of her statement that she made in her forensic interview. She never said, oh yeah, I lied about that. We might have a different issue if she had said that, but she maintained the truth of that allegation. And there's no case that the state's aware of or has come across where an accused denial of an accusation in itself is sufficient to establish that the accusation was indeed false. And so again, the state would argue that the trial court did not err by excluding that evidence. And as for appellant's second point of error, this court has explicitly held that reason to believe language does not constitute a comment on the complainant's truthfulness. Moreover, as was brought up, the trial court gave an instruction for the jury to disregard, and there's no evidence that the jury failed to heed to that instruction.
You don't think that the state, I haven't looked at the transcript, but I'm assuming that counsel's correct, that testimony was elicited as the sole question on redirect?
That may very well be the case.
And you don't see that as problematic as perhaps focusing the jury's attention on testimony that is conceded to have been improper?
You know, I'm not sure the motivation by the prosecutor at that time. I'm not really sure if that was what they were thinking. But again, this is somebody who wasn't even associated with CPS, who was asked whether that was found to be true or not. And there was no explanation even to the jury about what reason to believe means or anything like that. And so given that, the fact that it wasn't really given hardly any attention at all, it tends to suggest the jury did indeed disregard it. And unless the panel has any further questions, the state will conclude and respectfully ask that this court affirm appellant's conviction.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very briefly, appellant agrees that the Hammer case is one of the primary cases to take a look at when you assess this issue that we have before the court. If you look at Hammer at page 568, when it talks about the conflicts between the rules of evidence and constitutional things, the court states that the restrictions by the rules of evidence or remedies that should be used sparingly, especially in the he said, she said sexual molestation cases that must be resolved solely on the basis of the testimony of the complainant and the defendant, which of course is the situation we have here. And I did mention the Hammer case at page 12 of my brief. It was not left out.
Mr. Ball,
yes, ma'am.
Would you articulate for me the bias or the motive that this excluded testimony would have revealed?
Okay. Well, it started with, you know, the complaint started with a complaint to the mother about appellant only at the house. And then when we get to the next step in the investigation by the multidisciplinary team, when she's being questioned about what happened, and this young lady, our position was that she got relief from difficulties, like difficulties for staying up at night and not getting up in the morning, when she made the sexual assault complaint against her favorite uncle. So when she's in this interview room by herself and she's being asked questions about the appellant, she shores that up with making now a claim against her favorite cousin, three. And obviously at trial, she stuck with that story because that's what sometimes people will do, I guess. But we think that's it. Interestingly enough, when I went back through the record in a woefully, there was not a great deal of discussion about that. And it's because primarily the arguments in opposition to this evidence made by the state and articulated to Judge Young at trial were that the falsity hadn't been established.
Well, I was curious about the motive, like Justice Sutterith, because if you look at the state's brief, in a footnote that they dropped, they said that the argument that you just made only appeared at closing argument with regard to one of the motivations for the victim in this case to lie would be the fact that she had stayed up late. So I was curious if that is actually in the record other than in the closing argument.
Actually, if I remember the footnote, I think it's footnote number 2, but if I'm correct on this, if I read the state's brief correctly, they said that the argument that the child had used the complaint against appellant, the outcry against appellant of the sexual abuse, to divert attention and reduce the pressure for her not going to bed at night and being late for school, that argument was made not in conjunction with the admissibility of this, because it wouldn't have any particular relationship to that particular argument, because the information about 3 had not yet been produced. It was not produced until after the situation with the mother, and then the police get called, and that was later at the forensic interview. So if I understood their footnote correctly, they may be correct on when that argument was made in the record, but I don't believe that changes the analysis of the admission of 3's, the false outcry regarding 3. And going back to what if you look at the trial record, the discussion by Judge Young and the prosecution almost all centered on, well, it hasn't been established that this is false, taking the position, of course, that 3's denial is not does not establish that, which, of course, we disagree, and we think the law does not support that position.
I get your point that the theme from your perspective was that she was making this outcry to divert attention from something else. That was the motive. Okay. But I'm having trouble figuring out how the fact that she made an outcry twice during that same period of time would prove a false outcry, would prove the bias to get out of trouble. She's already gotten out of trouble by making the first false accusation. So what added benefit is it? What does that second one add?
It is less compelling than the first one, certainly. But if you look at the language of Carroll and how broad this constitutional requirement is for confrontation and cross-examination, I submit that it is sufficient because it doesn't require it to be a direct thing. It could be an inference and allow a jury to draw certain inferences from things. And one last thing, since my time is up, the question regarding it being the last question regarding the CPS reason to believe, if you look at the record, it was the last question. It was the only question, which I think clearly shows there was only one. It was purposeful, and it was only one purpose for it, and that was to shore up the credibility, and the state shouldn't be rewarded for that. And so we'd again ask for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. Your case has been submitted.